I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Timothy Caulfield joins me now. He recently published a new book, Relax, Damn It, A User's Guide to the Age of Anxiety. It's a good look at the myriad decisions we make and how a lot of us are concerned, sometimes paralyzed with worry as to whether we make good or bad choices, small and big, in our lives. The book is organized from the morning through to the late evening and explores the various decisions we need to make, from how much time we look at our cell phones to how much sleep we're getting, how we commute to and from work, how we work, like how much do we sit and stand, as well as exercise and what we eat. It's a fascinating book as well as sometimes worrying, and it's entertaining throughout. Timothy Caulfield is a Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy, a professor in the Faculty of Law and the School of Public Health, and Research Director of the Health Law Institute at the University of Alberta. He is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences, a frequent commentator in the press about pseudoscience and misinformation. He is also the author of two bestsellers, A Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness, and The Science of Celebrity, or Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? The Twitter handle is @CaulfieldTim. This new book is published by Alan Lane, an imprint of Penguin. We taped this interview in late December. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Timothy Caulfield. Professor Caulfield, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
So I was reading your book, and the chapter on handshaking, it seemed out of date already, because I liked handshaking, but it looks like it seems we won't be doing that anytime soon.
Yeah, that is interesting. You know, for the British version of the book, which comes out in January, I had just a little bit more time, so I actually did a pandemic postscript. And that is exactly one of the things that I zeroed in on was the handshaking. Of course, the fundamentals are still exactly the same. You know, the concern about spreading germs. Uh-huh. But what I think is really interesting is, what are we going to have 2 years from now? Is it going to be the fist bump? Is it going to be the elbow touch? And my guess, and you can have me back on, and we'll find out if it's right. I think it's the fist bump. I think we're going to be a generation of fist bumpers now.
Yeah, I only recently got comfortable with hugging other guys, and that as well is out. You know, no one's hugging anyone outside of their bubble nowadays, right?
That's right, and as you know from the book, I am also not a hugger, so that's something that I'm not going to miss. But you know, but having said that, you know, there's fascinating research, and Joe, there has been more since the pandemic that shows for many people it's really important. You know, there may be, you know, biological reasons why people want to be touched and want to be held. So, you know, I shouldn't discount it. You know, I shouldn't make light of it. But it will be really interesting to see how these long-standing customs, some of the, which, you know, as I say in the book, have perhaps a biological underpinning, to see how they come back or what form they take. It's really going to be interesting.
Yeah, because I've heard other things where, you know, habits obviously are easy to break sometimes, and that you know, a year from now we'll be back to normal, but for some people it might be to take longer, right?
You're exactly right, and cultural norms do shift.
Right.
You know, we've seen, you know, think about things like, you know, seat belts and smoking, and you know, there's so many things where we actually have been able to nudge. You know, even picking up litter, we have been able to nudge people, you know, populations in a particular direction, but. But this is a fascinating time because also think about how quickly we've adopted behaviors. You know, mask wearing being one of probably the most obvious. But behavior is difficult to change and very, very complex, which is a theme in the book, as you know.
And hand washing, I mean, we're all doing that probably a lot more than we did, say, a year ago. Do you think that's something that'll stick around? I mean, I hope so.
Yeah, another great suggestion, and as you know, I have a chapter in there, a very brief chapter on an ode to soap, because it really is remarkable how important soap is. You feel this very simple public health intervention, but hand washing is interesting because research since the pandemic, you know, over the past year, has shown that, people, an increasing number of people say they're washing their hands. You know, they say they're doing it, right? But there have been some objective studies done around the world that have found that, you know, hand washing continues, if you measure it objectively, right? Measured objectively, still pretty grim numbers. You know, some put it in the single digits, Joe, like, so not, you know, it's still pretty bad. But having said that, you know, I think that I love seeing this, a very straightforward, simple public health intervention like hand washing getting the attention it deserves.
Yeah, I've noticed some people rely on hand sanitizers more than actually washing their hands. And obviously, as we read in your book, that's not as good as, say, using just plain soap and water, right?
That's right. And, you know, this intervention that's been around literally thousands of years is remarkably effective, in part because it removes the dirt. It doesn't just, you know, sanitize your hand. It actually removes the dirt, and which is better, right?
Yeah.
And so, there have been studies that have been happened over the past year that have, again, emphasized that point, that good old-fashioned hand washing done well is a very effective public health intervention.
So with 2020 being a year like no other, I suppose that you've been called upon, like, unlike any other year in terms of all the misinformation out there. It's been a busy time for you, hasn't it?
It really has. It's been absolutely incredible. In fact, we have a couple of research grants on battling misinformation in the context of COVID, and it's been completely bonkers. I've been studying misinformation for decades, and I've never seen anything like this. Right? Not only in the amount of misinformation out there, but also the impact that it's having. You know, there's been an increasing body of evidence to suggest that, unfortunately, the spread of misinformation, which primarily is on social media, but not entirely, is really having an adverse impact on a bunch of dimensions. And, you know, not just our behavior, but also, you know, things like vaccination intention, but also on, you know, the polarization of our discourse, which is really unfortunate.
And all of this compounds to the anxiety that surrounds us, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's some fascinating research, which, you know, I love when it builds on the themes in the book as opposed to countering it. But there has been, an increasing body of evidence since the pandemic that suggests, and it's hard to study this well. It's an important caveat. It's hard to study these kind of phenomenon really well. But there is an increasing body of evidence that suggests that this chaotic information environment stresses us out more, right? It stresses us out more. And perhaps makes it more difficult for us to make good judgments about the content we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, Joe, this is really interesting. It may increase the likelihood that we're going to spread misinformation. So you get this horrible cycle happening that really has this adverse impact on all of us.
Is this the norm, though? I mean, will this be the norm moving forward? Or do you think we'll somehow get to where we were before?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's think of the good news first. The good news is I think that misinformation is being taken more seriously now than it ever has been before. You know, you hear the World Health Organization talking about the CDC, of course, the Public Health Agency of Canada. You know, everyone's taking it very, very seriously. So that's good news, right? And we're seeing all these interventions emerge. In fact, I'm involved in a number of them to try to battle misinformation, you know, wherever it may reside. The bad news is, you know, the social media platforms aren't going away. You know, celebrities aren't going away, which is another big source of misinformation.
Yeah.
We are, you know, the public discourse is getting increasingly polarized, and you have these silos of information, and which increase, you know, confirmation bias. So I think what we're going to settle into is this sort of ongoing fight against misinformation. And, you know, I categorize it as a fight, and maybe that's not the most constructive thing to do, because I think it's really important also to listen to people, right, and to really try to engage people to get a sense of what's drawing them to this misinformation. But I do think this is going to be a defining issue of our time, you know, the spread of misinformation and trying to counter that misinformation. One more bit of good news on this front is I do think there, and this has been going up and down, but I do think that after this there is going to be a growing recognition of the value of good science, right, and trustworthy science. And I think that I'm hopeful, you know, maybe I'm a little bit naive here because I love science so much, but I'm hopeful that's going to have an enduring impact also.
And this obviously will lead to us being less anxious. The thing that I found fascinating as I was starting your book was when you write about making decisions, because a lot of us have trouble figuring out what to do in life, big things and small. Some of us might put off making a decision, which is not beneficial at all. Some of us might not do anything at all, because it's just easier. In terms of your research over the years, what have you found in terms of why we are as we are when it comes to thinking of what to do?
Well, you know, you've outlined it really well. There are so many factors that impact how we make a decision, when we make a decision, whether the decision is going to stress us out. You know, for example, simple things like having a ton of options, right, stresses us out more. Mm. You know, we find it easier if we just have one specific option. The other thing is, you know, as I said before, this, you know, having this chaotic information environment can also stress us out. And of course, we live in a cultural moment where having a vast selection of choices is the point. The market wants you to have all these, you know, these. So it's almost kind of a worst case scenario. And adding to that is just this negativity bias that we have. You know, this fear, this tendency to be more moved by something that's scary, more fearful than by the positive. And our society, you know, as I argue in the book, has increasingly become this fear magnifier for various reasons. One of them I already touched on. We have this biological negativity bias. We're all wired to respond more strongly to the negative than to the positive, which makes evolutionary sense, right? But sure. Now, you know, we're living in a, you know, in this modern era, that biological tendency can backfire, and I think that happens, you know, all too often. So just being aware of those biases can have a big impact. And of course, one of the points of my book is really to try to get people to relax and to not let that noise cloud their judgment, not let that noise, you know, stress them out, and to really try to find a more straightforward path forward.
So when we get stressed out, when we get overwhelmed, some of us like to take to social media or to our loved ones and just rant. What have you found in terms of the research of how beneficial it is to, say, get something off your chest?
Yeah, ranting, you know, I really enjoyed that part of the book, researching, writing that part of the book. In fact, my editor made me cut it down a little bit because I got so into it. There's a fascinating history about ranting. This idea of venting and catharsis, it's become sort of embedded in our pop culture, right, that it's a good thing to do. And as I point out, I give a couple examples in that chapter about how you know, it really has become part of the cultural ethos. You're supposed to vent, and if you don't, it's bad for you emotionally and perhaps even physically, which, you know, none of that's true. And what's interesting is there's never been any evidence to back up venting. It really, you know, it's been around for a long time, this idea, but it really took off sort of from a clinical perspective, from a health perspective. I think Freud gets a lot of credit for it. You know, he really, you know, gave this idea of catharsis legs, I'll put it that way. And it hasn't died out. It really hasn't died out, even though there has never been evidence to support it. You know, lots of times, you know, in the book there's a couple sort of myths that used to have evidence, or we didn't know what it was, and so you can understand why people were drawn to the idea. But this is fascinating because there's really never been evidence to support it. And we've known that for a very long time. And despite that, it goes on. So the bottom line is, you know, venting, generally speaking, I call it, you know, an emotional, it's like McDonald's, like a fast food, right? Yeah, McRant. Yeah. Because you get this short-term pleasure, often very short-term, but in fact, long-term it almost is always detrimental. And in fact, fuels your emotional rage. It doesn't quell it at all. So and I think one of the reasons, Joe, that it survived also is because it has intuitive appeal, right? It makes sense. And there's a lot of other things in the book that I think have enduring appeal because of that intuitiveness to it. You know, it feels right. But just because something feels right doesn't mean the science is going to back it up.
Indeed. And the marvelous anecdote that you write about, antidote, I should say, that you write about at the end of that chapter on ranting is the thank you note, which I found incredibly useful, especially because of this time of year. It's a good thing to do, right?
It is, and you know, I want to be careful not to overinterpret the existing evidence on it. You know, maybe I'm a little biased myself, but there is some evidence to suggest that, yeah, instead of ranting, you know, find someone, find some reason or some person that is worthy of a thank you note. And there's evidence that shows that not only is the person who received it going to love it, almost almost without equivocation,
yeah.
But it helps you too. There's emotional benefit for both the sender and the receiver. So instead of a rant, make it a thank you.
Indeed. Another fascinating thing, I should say, in your book is when you write about standing desks. I've reached you, I guess, at your office. Is that right? Are you at a standing desk?
I'm not, because I'm at my home.
Oh, I see.
But I do have a standing desk in my office, which I've used since they came out.
And so you write in the book, and I just found this terribly interesting, is that there are some people who use those desks and are forgoing exercise because they think that they're healthy enough just standing.
That's right. And I love, you know, standing desks, I thought was a really good example of a couple of things. First of all, you know, I was all in immediately,
yeah.
You know, and it's not really on brand for me to go with, you know, trendy wellness
sure.
things.
Yeah.
But again, I thought it was great immediately. And, but despite the marketing and despite what a lot of people have heard, you know, that smoking is the new, sitting is the new smoking. I'm sure people have heard that.
Yeah.
Right. The evidence around standing desks and sedentary behavior is very complex and very mixed, and a standing desk is not going to be a magical solution. And as you point out, there's some evidence, again, hard to study this well, that you get this strange compensation behavior. So people stand throughout the day, and I'll leave it as a question mark because the evidence is still emerging. You know, but does that mean you exercise less at home or otherwise? And then in the aggregate, is it doing you harm? So it's I really use that one as an example of how complex the research can really be around even a simple intervention like a standing desk.
And your advice in the book is when in doubt, just keep moving, right?
Yeah, move. You know, I'm on social media all the time and hashtag move.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things that how my thinking has changed a little bit, Joe. It's evolved. You know, I used to be very much about, you know, this is the kind of exercise you should do, and this is how you can maximize your fitness. And now, you know, I've kind of let that go because we just get so much benefit from simply moving, and we get the biggest bang from getting sedentary people to move. So the bottom line is, when you can, simply move.
Indeed. What's your advice for people who are bombarded with news? And you know how it is online or on television or radio, and there's news of a new study, say. And knowing how to sort through whether that's a good study to follow or to change your life about, you know?
Yeah, you know, in the book I try to give some basic steps that people can take. You know, people often hear about critical thinking, and people may think that that's this really calm, you know, you have to take a class or something. But there are really some straightforward steps that you can take. And one of them is to ask yourself, what kind of evidence is being used to back this up? So ask yourself, are they representing the body of evidence? And especially with something like health, it's always going to take the body of evidence to make a difference. So it's never going to be one study, right? You got to say, you know, we're complex creatures living in a complex environment, and you've got to look to the body of evidence. Secondly, is it just an observational study? And this is very common in the context of health studies. Or is it a clinical trial? Did they really try to get a sense of what's causing something? And also ask yourself, is it an animal study? If that's the case, probably ignore it. Is it a small study? If that's the case, probably ignore it. So really ask yourself, what is the evidence? And always try to turn to an entity that is aggregating the science in a responsible manner and turn to that body of evidence on almost any topic in the realm of health.
And we've been talking now for about 20 minutes. I haven't looked at my phone once, so that's pretty good, right?
That's excellent. That's excellent. You know, as you know, throughout the book, I keep reminding people, you know, perhaps, you know, try to take a break from social media, from your email, and for sure from your phone. Don't put it by your bed at night. Don't look at it first thing in the morning, and
yeah.
Don't look at it while you're sitting on the toilet. You know, take a break from that noise.
There was a study in the book, though, and I'm wondering how it holds up in terms of people who check their email frequently during the day as opposed to those that, say, check them two or three times a day in terms of productivity. But what happened there in terms of who was more productive? Because the fascinating thing was that what was found in that study with people who did it one way went to the other way.
You're right, and again, it's one of those areas where the literature is often more complex than represented. Again, a lot of these productivity gurus will tell you you're supposed to cache your email, you don't do it all at once. And what they found was it may help you a little bit with productivity, but it stressed you out because you may have a job where you're required to go to your email.
Sure.
On the other end of the continuum, if you're constantly checking your email, that you can, you know, you're not going to be productive at all. Your productivity, you know, goes down to almost zero, right? So what you need to do is find that balance that works for you. And, you know, I'm a writer, and I, you know, you think I have these great swaths of time. I even try to sometimes just block it for half an hour or so. Just try to find a rhythm that works for you and works for the kind of job you have. You know, Joe, of all the chapters I worked on in the book, that was the one that perhaps changed my life the most.
Yeah.
Because I am not, you know, I'm on social media and I get so much email from my academic work. I do get distracted from that stuff. So I've really tried to walk the walk with that and try to be responsible in my email management. And it's had a huge impact, you know, both in my stress level but also on my productivity.
Yeah, I've noticed I changed phones recently from a BlackBerry to an iPhone. And the BlackBerry used to just update itself, and so every time you got an email, the light would go off or you'd hear a noise. The iPhone doesn't do that, or mine at least doesn't, and I don't want to change it because I like the fact that I'll only see updates when I want it to update.
Yeah, don't turn off all your alert unless you know if you're waiting for the Nobel Prize Committee to
sure.
call you, or you have a baby on the way. I get
or,
it.
Or a password change thing that I need.
Yeah. You know? Otherwise, you know, turn off all your alerts, right, and don't let it disrupt your day.
I noticed that the you mentioned the English or the British version of the book. The American version has a different title.
That's right. In the U.S., it's called Your Day, Your Way, and Canada, it's called Relax, Damn It. And in the U.K., it's called Just Relax. And I think that each one of the publishers wanted to just sort of emphasize a different theme. In the United States, you know, it's very much going to be a push in January. So I think it's a very positive, a more positive spin to the messaging in the book. So Your Day, Your Way, you know, take control of the noise. And then in Canada, they didn't shy away from the relaxed summit.
Indeed. The thing I was surprised by, but at the end of the day, it doesn't surprise me, is how this feeling of frustration came about me as I was finishing the book, in that this is stuff that we all know fundamentally, but we overlook. And I'm sure a lot of people tell you this, that, you know, this is, we know better, but yet, you know, it takes us, you know, the time to read a book like yours to, I guess, put everything in perspective and realize what's good for us.
Exactly right. And thank you for saying that, because that's exactly what, you know, the core theme of the book. And also to highlight all of these social forces, you know, the misinformation, fear-mongering, ideology a little bit, that pull us away from what you just highlighted, right, those science-informed fundamentals, that, you know, this easier way forward, because society's structured to try to get us not to do that. And so, you know, this invitation to relax and to focus on these science-informed fundamentals, particularly in the context of health, but also, you know, parenting and even in the things that you do recreationally, you know, there often is sort of this easier, more relaxed, and more science-informed way forward.
Indeed. And even the chapter on public toilets and how safe they were. You know, you give us the evidence, obviously, that they are a lot safer than we think they are. I've not necessarily been moved by it. I don't know. Have you?
you're right. You know, we often worry about the wrong things in the public health, public toilet seat chapter is a good example of that. You know, I try to have fun. As you know, in the book, I have some topics that are more serious and some are a little bit more fun, but they all have the same theme, right? Often the evidence and perhaps more provocatively, the cultural forces that shape our decisions are the same. You know, whether you're talking about a big decision about whether your kids should walk to school or whether you're talking about sitting on a toilet seat.
I enjoyed the book a great deal. I laughed out loud a few places, and just found it so edifying, especially this time of year when we're looking back and looking ahead. Congratulations on the book, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks so much, Joe. Really appreciate it.
The Twitter handle is at Caulfield Tim. The book is called Relax, Damn It, A User's Guide to the Age of Anxiety. It is published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin. Timothy Caulfield joined me on the line from Edmonton, Alberta, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.